is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, April 16, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. With Iraqis protesting US presence in their country, Washington intensifies war rhetoric against Syria. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat rejects the proposed cabinet by the newly appointed Prime Minister. And as Coca-Cola shareholders meet today, Colombians tell them of human rights abuses committed by the company. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The 53-member United Nations Human Rights Commission today voted on a U.S.-backed European Union resolution condemning North Korea for human rights violations. Heather Risby has more from the U.N.
The move came 2 days after the U.N. Security Council meeting that discussed North Korea's nuclear weapons program, but failed to issue any statement because of opposition from Russia and China. It's the first time the European Union has accused North Korea of human rights violations at the UN Rights Forum. North Korea rejected the US-European resolution, saying it would aggravate the situation in the region, a view that was endorsed by a South Korean foreign ministry spokesman who announced that his country would abstain from the voting. North Korea's neighbor, China, which is hosting the U.S.-proposed talks in Beijing next week, also opposed the resolution on similar grounds. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Risby at the United Nations.
Opposition party leaders in Nigeria say last weekend's parliamentary elections were so riddled with abuses that they are insisting on throwing out the results. They want new elections to be held before presidential elections, now scheduled for the upcoming weekend. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
Since independence from Britain more than 40 years ago, Nigeria never had a successful transition from one democratic government to another. All previous elections aimed at doing this have ended in allegations of rigging and consequently military coups. Last Saturday's parliamentary elections were marked by violence, which left more than 10 people dead in parts of the country. In some polling stations, gunmen forcefully took away ballot boxes. President Olusegun Obasanjo, a Christian from the south, is standing re-election. His main challenger is a Muslim from the north. Thousands of people have been killed in religious violence since Nigeria returned to democratic rule 4 years ago. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
An appeals court issued an unexpected last-minute reprieve for one Texas death row prisoner yesterday due to allegations by the defense that the man is mentally retarded and therefore not subject to state execution. From KPFT in Houston, Renee Feltz reports on how this case may open the door for a new category of mentally retarded inmates.
Tuesday night, Kenneth Wayne Morris became the third Texas death row prisoner granted a stay of execution based on a claim of mental retardation. A ninth-grade dropout who took special education classes, Morris was convicted in the shooting death of a Houston businessman. The 32-year-old illiterate black man's case is unique. Although he meets all other mental retardation diagnostic standards, he has no IQ score in his school records to present as evidence of his mental status. His attorneys say Tuesday's court order offers hope for older death row inmates whose school records may have been lost or destroyed, leaving them in a similar situation.
It opens up an avenue for some people who may well be mentally retarded, but who are simply too old to get access to the records. And that, I think, is a measure of fairness.
Morris can now petition a lower federal court to grant him assistance in obtaining an IQ test. In Houston, Texas, I'm Renee Felt for Free Speech Radio News.
Microsoft agreed to pay Florida consumers as much as $202 million to settle a class action lawsuit that claims the software giant with overcharging for their products. If a judge approves the settlement in the fall, any person or business that purchased a Windows operating system or any other Microsoft product between November 1995 and December of 2002 will receive a voucher to purchase software from any vendor, including Microsoft. Bill Newton with the Florida Consumer Action Network says the deal is a drop in the bucket for consumers, but such lawsuit pressure does encourage corporate change.
Even though consumers aren't getting like a big amount of money back, you know, you may get a few dollars or $5 or something like that, it does force the company to change their behavior. And without that, you know, we have no protection.
The Florida settlement pales a recent similar one in California. In the year 2002, Microsoft had a net profit of more than $2.7 billion, or 35% of profit on all sales. By comparison, the next largest profit maker in the tech industry is Intel, with 13% profit on sales. I'm Randy Zimmerman with Free Speech Radio News.
Witnesses are reporting that at least 10 people were shot dead and many were wounded in the northern Iraqi town of Mosul when U.S. troops opened fire on a crowd after it turned against an American-installed local governor. According to eyewitnesses, U.S. Marines fired when the crowd noisily interrupted the governor's speech. Agence France-Presse, meanwhile, is reporting that the U.S. has been banning the media from anti-U.S. protests in Iraq, saying that U.S. forces yesterday tried to stop the media from covering a third day of anti-American protests by Iraqis outside Hotel Palestine. And U.S. troops have been given a deck of playing cards containing the pictures of Saddam Hussein and his government ministers, in which Saddam appears as the ace of spades and his younger son is the ace of clubs. Every card, however, carries a death sentence, since frontline troops have been ordered to use them to identify suspects who must be killed or captured. U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell said today that Washington has grave concerns about the policies of Syria and Iran, but he said that as yet there were no plans to launch an attack against either country. In recent days, however, American officials have intensified their war rhetoric against Syria, accusing the Ba'athist dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad of sheltering fleeing Iraqi officials, developing weapons of mass destruction, and harboring Palestinian militants committed to violence against the State of Israel. Aaron Glantz reports from Amman.
Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon told the Yehidot Aharonot newspaper yesterday Syria's president is dangerous because he opposed the U.S. war on Iraq and is, quote, capable of making the same error over the balance of forces with Israel that he made with the Americans. A Syrian counterproposal came today. The country's foreign minister, Farouk El-Sharwan, told Australian television his country was ready to immediately sign and implement an accord banning weapons of mass destruction from the entire Middle East. Neither Syria nor Israel admits to possessing weapons of mass destruction, but both countries are known to have large stockpiles of chemical weapons, and Israel is known to possess an arsenal of more than 200 nuclear warheads, most of them stationed in the country's southern Negev desert. Jamal Tahat is an independent political analyst based in Amman.
Any speak about weapon of mass destruction it's not convincing at all that you are coming here and attacking Syria because Syria has weapons of mass destruction. It's not the issue. I think the issue now in the Middle East to striking a peace deal, you know, and impose this deal through a regional new security regime. And this security regime should include this issue that all parties are banned from getting weapons of mass destruction. Maybe you can give some concessions to Israel to some extent, somehow, but not keep it as open issue to be discussed forever.
The Syrian policy of support for Palestinian groups waging a low-scale war on Israel is also popular throughout the Arab world. While Israel's other major border states, Egypt and Jordan, have closed the offices of Hamas and Islamic Jihad, calling them terrorist groups, the group's offices remain open in Damascus, as does the office of the paramilitary force Hezbollah, which fought the Israeli army in South Lebanon for close to 20 years. Basil Burgan is a politically active businessman. He shares an opinion popular on the Arab street.
Without Hezbollah, Israel would not have withdrawn from the south of Lebanon, which they have occupied for more than 10 years, 15 years, benefiting out of the water resources of Lebanon, diverting the Lebanese rivers into Israel, and making the security blanket, which was obvious, it failed. So they have the right, as much as the Palestinians do have the right to resist the occupation of Israel, because the major cause of the problem, you know, if the Israeli-Arab problem or the Israeli-Palestinian problem is the occupation. You end the occupation, you withdraw, you do not stall or delay or play around withdrawal, you know, you get suicide bombers.
But support from the Arab street is unlikely to bring the Ba'athist dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad any support from the Bush administration. Today, U.S. military forces cut the Iraqi oil flow to Syria. It's the first sign of the kind of steps U.S. officials will be willing to take to pressure Assad's regime, and it's also the first time the American army has shown its willingness to use its control of Iraq's vast oil resources as a political tool to advance the Bush agenda on the world stage. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Amman, Jordan.
Meanwhile, a two-day Athens summit, which will oversee the expansion of the European Union to 25 states, is also expected to issue a joint statement on Iraq, despite deep splits between the so-called coalition countries of Britain, Spain and Italy and the remainder of Europe. We're joined now by investigative journalist Greg Pallast. So, Greg Pallast, we're looking at the meeting of the EU in Greece. They're considering these new 10 nations to become part of the EU bloc. What does this mean for the world?
This is Henry Kissinger's wet dream come true. See, Kissinger always had the idea that the EU could be defanged by diluting it with a bunch of U.S.-dependent allies. So when you get nations like Estonia, it's kind of giving a shadow vote in the EU to Dick Cheney. So all you need to complete the process is add in Turkey, and it's pretty much a done deal. Now, of course, why would the EU allow these nations in then when this means huge shadow influence of the United States, is that if they leave them out, then they have a low-wage competitive area that surrounds the EU. So France, Germany, and Britain really have not a lot of choice on allowing the countries in. On the other hand, it means that they're not so independent of the U.S. as the EU has been to date.
Talk about the timing, Greg. It's now looking like the division or the carve-up of Iraq won't go so easily to the United States. What role can the EU play in this?
Well, I think everyone will be grabbing for the big contracts, obviously. And, of course, this reshapes the entire world of oil. For the first time, we have Tommy Franks, who is in effect, and General Garner, who are in effect the kind of military junta for Iraq, will now have a vote in OPEC. And so you're talking about nations where this will have a huge impact in the reorganization. Not only when we talk about oil, we're also talking about the movement of petrodollars. So this is going to be, there's a lot of things that will be affected. You're talking about nations which now will have, which now represent the nations that will have the gas pipelines that run to Europe from Russia. Those prices will change. This is a huge, the takeover of Iraq, whether you call it a liberation or conquest, has enormous long-term implications in finance internationally and especially for Europe. So this is huge. The question is now, does this give more authority to the Western Europeans or less? Probably less. It really means that the U.S. hegemony is really solidified, I think, by this move.
And we also see British Prime Minister Tony Blair backtracking in a way, French President Jacques Chirac saying that this is going to be a peaceful coalition of countries. Do you think this might actually stand in the way of any future plans to attack, say, Syria or Iran?
Yeah, I think that the saber rattling over Syria is a bit of silliness. Syria has the advantage that it has no oil. let's face it. For all the saber rattling, there's not much to be had for in an occupation of that nation. But there is, you know, Syria and France have had this long colonial relationship of love hate, so that's affected there as well. No, I don't think that there's going to be an immediate invasion anywhere else at this moment. But, you know, France at this moment has to figure out how to work itself back into the action in Iraq. The most important thing from their viewpoint, and Russia has been very blunt about this, is no forgiveness of debts, of Iraqi debts. The Iraqis owe money, and they have contracts with the French and the Russians. And I think that's what the French are bargaining for, is to maintain their current contracts in the Iraqi oil fields and for the Russians to get the money that is owed back to them. No forgiveness of Iraqi debts is going to be the big theme for the Russians.
Greg Pellis, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. 2 weeks ago, a U.S. District Court judge ruled that cases of human rights abuses against Coca-Cola Colombian bottlers Panamaco and Bebidas will be allowed to go forward under the Alien Tort Claims Act. This, as the annual shareholders' meeting for Coke took place in Houston today. Colombian labor leader William Mendoza traveled to the meeting to draw attention to human rights violations committed by multinational corporations and to refute Coke's claim that the lawsuit is, quote, a shameless effort to generate publicity using the name of our company, its trademarks and brands. Jackson Allers of Pacifica Station KPFT reports from the shareholder meeting.
Coca-Cola cites the U.S. district ruling as a victory because the plaintiff, Colombian Food and Beverage Union, Sinalchonal, failed to prove Coke was responsible for human rights abuses at the bottling plants in Colombia. Reading from a press release this morning, company spokesperson Ben Deutsch says the soft drink company is confident their Colombian bottlers have nothing to worry about.
One of the Coca-Cola company's fundamental principles for conducting business around the world is its respect for human and labor rights. We treat all of our employees in nearly 200 countries in which we do business with fairness, dignity, and respect. We operate in accordance with local laws, and we contribute to the communities we serve. The Coca-Cola company and its Colombian bottlers vigorously condemn all forms of violence and the unwarranted use of force against workers in the workplace or elsewhere.
Coca-Cola claims its Colombian employees are simply caught in the crossfire of a civil war that has been raging for nearly 40 years. But co-counsel in the lawsuit, Dan Kovalik of the United Steelworkers of America, says the official statements from Coke management contradict what workers in Colombia are experiencing on the ground.
Employees are witnessing paramilitaries walk in the bottling Coca-Cola bottling plants in Colombia, for example, in the town of Barranca Bermeja. They not only walk in, they actually sign the security sign-in sheet, and they're seen meeting with management. And the management are openly supporting the paramilitaries in the conflict, and they're there to protect Coca-Cola's interests.
According to Kovalik, Coca-Cola's denial of human rights abuses sounds familiar. Paramilitary groups killed 8 union leaders at a Coke bottling plant in Guatemala in the 1970s, and only after a consumer boycott in the United States was pressure put on Coca-Cola to sever ties with their Guatemalan bottlers, this according to Kovalik. In 1996, a labor leader with Sinalchonal in Colombia, Isidro Gil, was assassinated inside a Coke plant. Gil was a vocal organizer against the policies of Coke, and the plaintiffs in the lawsuit alleged the paramilitaries that killed Gil were acting on orders from Coke management. Coke denies the claim. The most recent human rights report from the State Department concludes that paramilitaries are responsible for a majority of trade unionist assassinations in Colombia. Meanwhile, Colombian trade union leader William Mendoza says the Coca-Cola company is not the only problem. Although he is targeting Coke's policies, Coke bottlers are only a reflection of a larger trend of labor abuse occurring as foreign companies move into developing countries around the world.
This is part of the policy of the state itself. The allowance of all the transnational companies, all the big corporations to do whatever they want in Colombia, letting them to suck all the profits that they can from our working class, from our communities, disregarding any benefits that my people in Colombia may have or any rights that they can have.
Today, President Bush signed a $79 billion war supplemental, funneling $34 million in, quote, counter-narcotics aid to Colombia, this in addition to $400 million Congress authorized last year. From Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston, this is Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, the Israeli military completely sealed off the West Bank and Gaza, saying the closure will stay in effect until the end of the Passover holiday Sunday. The Israeli military also imposed checkpoints inside the Gaza Strip, separating the territory into 3 isolated areas. This is the United Nations Commission on Human Rights, quote, strongly condemned Israel's military occupation as, quote, a flagrant violation of human rights. The UN resolution also criticized Israeli settlements, the strict military-imposed curfews, and the security wall the Israeli military is building around the occupied territories. And as Awad Dwabes reports, Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat rejected the proposed cabinet by newly appointed Prime Minister Mahmoud Abu Mazen, making many Palestinians uneasy.
Palestinians are trapped between their hopes that this new cabinet assembled by Prime Minister Abbas Abu Mazen might ease their daily life and fears that the new cabinet will serve as a puppet authority. Names chosen by Abu Mazen are viewed by Palestinian political observers as a revolt against Yasser Arafat and his traditional camp within the government. The selection of these particular Palestinians also have many worried, drawing similarities between this new cabinet appointment and the American plan currently being pieced together in Iraq. Imad Asfar is a political analyst.
The new governmental formula will face many problems in the Palestinian society. It has no support within the Palestinians. Many of them began from now to say it's very similar to the Ahmed Chalabi ministry in Iraq.
Prominent current ministers are absent in the new cabinet, including two main Arafat loyals, Yasser Abed Rabbo, Minister of Information, and Saeb Arakat, Chief Negotiator and Minister of Local Government. Another point of conflict during the cabinet appointment centered on the makeup of the Interior Ministry, with a strong opposition from Arafat Fatah faction. Mohammed Dahlan, former Chief of Preventive Security in the Gaza Strip, was a newly named Minister of State for Interior Affairs, and Abu Mazen named himself Minister of Interior. Differences in these cabinet appointments seem to reflect the power conflict between Yasser Arafat and his newly appointed prime minister. Hatem Abdel Qader is a Palestinian Fatah deputy.
The majority of this cabinet is not support Yasser Arafat. It is important for us and it is important for Jamal Arafat. It is power, it is political power. We are talking about political problems.
Even as the Palestinian leadership wrestles over the new cabinet for Palestinians who live under the Israeli occupation, the new cabinet might signal a new era and gain some popular support. Again, political analyst Imad Asfar.
This government, if it can give the Palestinian some hopes, what they need, it could be success. But this depends on the Israeli.
Basim Shahada, who works in a company in Ramallah, agrees.
It could bring hope for the Palestinians who are living under Israeli siege and closure, curfews and occupations, and for a couple of years.
A hard daily life for Palestinians that might be eased by the new cabinet, but political concessions are not permitted and Palestinian red lines must not be crossed, according to Basim.
No one's going to make concessions on certain issues. For example, they won't make concessions on settlement or in Jerusalem or either in the refugees. There are certain red lines. No one will have the courage even to cross them.
Still, the main results in this question remain in the hands of the Israeli government currently occupying the entire Palestinian territories. I'm Awad Daibes reporting for Free Speech Radio News, Ramallah.
At their meetings in Washington, D.C. this past weekend, the World Bank and International Monetary Fund declared that while progress is being made towards reducing global poverty, countries in Africa will increasingly face what they called crushing poverty. The World Bank calls on rich countries to lower their trade barriers to boost growth in developing countries. On March 28, the Gambia was added to 37 other African countries who are hoping to benefit from the African Growth and Opportunities Act, or AGOA. But some analysts are warning that AGOA is more about American business profits and strategic interests. From the Gambia, Patrick Beckett has this report.
The Gambia is one of Africa's smallest and poorest nations, ranking near the bottom of the United Nations 2000 Human Development Index. With more than $350 million in debt remaining, even after recent debt relief initiatives, the country's main industries of peanuts and tourism cannot lift the Gambia out of its poverty. Gambian economists are hoping the African Growth and Opportunities Act and a World Bank-sponsored free export zone will attract foreign investors to the country. Cherno Jallo is the principal economist for the Gambian Chamber of Commerce.
They may take advantage of this opportunity that Gambia has to relocate their company to the Gambia, take advantage of the low cost of labor, right, and take advantage of the duty concessions that we have to enter the American market.
The African Growth and Opportunities Act, or AGOA, was signed into law in May of 2000. Claiming the act represents a new era of development assistance to Africa, the U.S. administration links access to the U.S. market with what it calls good governance requirements. But AGOA has been criticized for its focus on free market principles rather than democracy and human rights, as well as its extensive conditionalities. Dot Keat is with the South African Alternative Information Center.
And what the so-called donor countries or the rich countries define as good governance is not necessarily what we in Africa would define as good governance. For example, and you hear this constantly from President Bush, that country X or country Y is a reliable, sensible government because, and really I quote Bush, they are following sound economic policies, liberalization of trade, government handing over their responsibilities to private enterprise, privatizing public services. This is regarded as being good economic governance. That is not how we see it.
Chair Nojalo says the Gambian government will continue to be involved in public utilities to ensure they are affordable to the people. He admits partnerships with foreign investors may be a short-term fix, but hopes that local industrial production can eventually take root in the country. But conditions today are conducive to foreign investment. Again, Jalo.
We have a $16 million project financed by the World Bank, which is going to establish free zones in the Gambia, free export zones, where we intend to attract companies from other parts of the world to come and establish in the free zones to produce and export to wherever, Europe or America. So this AGOA fits in to that policy. Mm-hmm.
Dot Keat says AGOA is more about opportunities for the United States, not Africa, and points out there are more than 30 conditionalities built into the act.
This isn't about trade. It's about U.S. investment. Okay, the property rights of U.S. investors, the guarantee of the repatriation of their profits of U.S. investors, the intellectual property rights, the right to participate in government procurement within our countries, the right to national treatment within our countries. I mean, it's vast. It even goes to the extent of including a clause to the effect that governments must not pursue policies or actions that are hostile to U.S. strategic interests.
From The Gambia, Patrick Beckett for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced by Kata Mesta at the studios of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. Headline editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram at WMNF in Tampa, Florida. Technical producers are Jade Paget-Seekins and Pauline Bartolone at Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley. Josh Chaffin is our DC editor at Pacifica Station WPFW. Web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. You can visit FSRN online at www.fsrn.org. I'm Deepa Fernandez.